I know you're going to enjoy her, and I'll let you see what kind of a person she is. Let's give Beverly a nice welcome from West Virginia.
Hi, I'm Beverly Ross, and I'm a very grateful member of the Al-Anon family group. And I'm most specifically from the Rivercrest Al-Anon group in Fort Worth, Texas, and I'm very thrilled to be here. Kitty called me quite a while ago. I don't know. It seemed like months and months and months and months ago. And I figured you all were very well organized, and I tried to sound very well organized. After you all just broke up and went into hysterics over her moving the mic, I said, they're going to be a really easy audience to talk to. They laugh at anything, you know. So if I'm not saying anything, I'm going to run it up and down so you all can get a good laugh. I want to really thank Kitty a lot. She called early, and we made our little deal, and I know she told me that I was coming to, out to a 4-H camp and so forth and so on, but it was a long, long time ago that I talked to her, and in the meantime, I'm really pretty well organized, but I lost my address book with her name, address, telephone number, and everything in it, and I kept thinking, and my husband kept saying, don't worry about that, because I've got the name in the computer. I've got her name in my computer. So finally I said, you know how we just rely upon the alcoholic? I always believed everything he said, and so I said, I never had a moment's worry, and so I said, well, listen, I think it's time I called her. And he said, I guess I didn't tell you my computer program went down, and I don't have her name. And I went, you don't have her name? And he said, no. And so I thought, well, she may not even live in Charleston, you know. And I wasn't real sure whether it was Charleston, South Carolina, Charleston, West Virginia, you know. And so anyway, I ascertained through another little note that it was West Virginia. So I thought, well, I'll just call the Al-Anon Central Office, which I did. And they hooked me up to the AA people. And they said, I said, have you ever heard of Kitty Kay? And this man said, well, I think I have. And I said, told him what my problem was. And a meeting was going on. They weren't as concerned about my problem as I was. But they said they knew an Al-Anon, and they would get him in touch with me. Well, he didn't get in touch with me for a little bit. And so I started phoning through the information. I'd call information. They'd give me two Ks, and I would call those Ks. And finally, I got a K. And I said, they said, no, this is not Kitty Kay. And I said, well, have you ever, this was always my same thing, have you ever heard of Kitty Kay? Finally, I found somebody that had heard of Kitty Kay. And when she gave me, I didn't think she sounded real enthusiastic, like she just thought it was a wonderful person. But I thought, just, well, the number is this. And I found out later I had called the home of her husband's former wife. But if you're a good Al-Anon, you know how to just keep on keeping on. I was going to go right through that phone book. After we left K, we'd go to another name, and somebody surely had heard of her someplace. But anyway, this is the most beautiful place. I have just so honored to be here, and I want to thank Jarv and Kitty and all the committee for inviting me. This is so exciting. It's the very first time I've ever been in West Virginia, and it looks like God's country. You cannot imagine, if you come from Texas, what West Virginia looks like. Beautiful. I mean, I just hope I can get some pictures to take back. It is absolutely lovely. Now, I will not say that I enjoyed landing on the side of a mountain or on the top of it, but other than that, the amenities have been wonderful. But anyway, when I got here, I realized that I had not dressed for the 4-H camp. And so I thought it would be, in something like, a holodome or a convention center or something. And so I said, as I realized she was throwing on shorts and, everybody was giggling and putting on baseball hats, I thought, ooh, I am in deep trouble. So I said, is there a mall around here? And she said, yes. And so I got to go down to the mall, and we sort of slam dunked Kaufman's, and so everything you'll see that I have on this weekend except this dress was bought in West Virginia, you know. My husband may not be too happy about that, but I'm a lot more comfortable, you know. Anyway, it's so exciting for me to talk to an Al-Anon convention because I had never planned to be an Al-Anon. I'd never heard of Al-Anon in my whole life. I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous forever, but I had never heard of Al-Anon. No one had ever mentioned it to me. Surely 11 and 12 years ago, it was, you know, they had things, but I didn't hear it. And I'd never heard the name. And my husband came to AA a year before I came to Al-Anon, and I remember very well as he would set off every night to go down there when I would tell him on a daily basis, I don't know why you're going down there. You are not an alcoholic. You have never been an alcoholic, and they're going to find out about you, and they're going to kick you out, you know. And I said, now I want to tell you, oh, he just loved AA. Oh, he loved AA. Went around the park, told everybody he joined Alcoholics Anonymous. It was so embarrassing because I was saying all the time he was not an alcoholic and, you know, just that kind of thing. He went up to the country club and took three people down and said, listen, you need what I have. And he took them down to this meeting and they didn't want to go, you know, and they've never been back, you know. So knowing his enthusiasm, I said, now if there is something down there like Alcolette, I want to tell you. That I have been a Rotary Ann, I have done all of those things, and I am not going to be an alcoholic. So he didn't ask me, and no one to my knowledge ever said a word to me about Al-Anon. I mean, I knew he was going night and day to AA. Well, after I got to Al-Anon, I became very aware that I went into just, you know, oh, why didn't I go to Al-Anon? Oh, if I had only gone, maybe he would have come to AA earlier. And I really felt really bad about it. And the Al-Anon said, honey, knowing you, if you had come first, he'd probably still be out there drinking, you know. And that was the truth. But the way God healed that, and it was really a pain for me, you know, I cried about it. Oh, if only I'd come, you know, and all of that stuff. And the way God healed that for me was after we had been in the program about another year, we hadn't had enough money to go to Granbury, Texas, which is about 30 miles away, but, you know, the alcoholic... He said, we're going to take this trip. And I said, where are we going? You know, thinking we're going to go down, you know, on some lake or something. He said, we're going to the Virgin Islands. And I went, the Virgin Islands, you know. And then I started, well, I better check the checkbook, you know, the way we are. But anyway, he took me on this lovely trip. And it was the first big trip we'd had in about 20 years. And we were on the plane and we were not seated together. And I was about four rows up from him. And just, it was beautiful. We flew over a double rainbow. And, oh, I mean, it was just a gorgeous trip. And in the plane. And so it was a gorgeous trip till this point. We were about halfway on the plane down there, and suddenly the little stewardess started down the aisle, and she was going, coffee, tea, or do you want a drink? Coffee, tea, or do you want a drink? You know, I'm thinking, he can handle that. You know, I don't need to go back there and help him, you know. And so she was adorable. You know, she had this little waist, this precious little bust line, and she's just going down the aisle like this. And so he loves women. And so it got down to him, and she said, you know, everybody else said Coke, soda, you know, scotch and water, three highballs or whatever. They got to him, and she said, coffee, tea, or do you want a drink? And he went, oh, I don't want a drink. I drank my way into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Well... You know, anonymity was the part of the program I liked. You know, where was anonymity? You know? So she said, you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, like that. And he went, yeah. And then he just took her drink by drink through 20 years of the worst alcoholic stories you've ever heard. And I was the only person on the plane not listening to him. They had gotten up on their knees and, you know, and they were leaning over. People in the back were saying, back here with the drinks, you know. The middle of the plane would say, there's an alcoholic up there, you know. Well, when he got to the end of his story, he said, now, if you want to know the real tough side of the story, you need to ask my wife, Beverly. She's right up there. And I swear, the whole plane went like this. You know? Well, we got down to the islands, and I was down on the beach, and he had been sitting next to a lawyer from Dallas, a trial lawyer who had been an assistant district attorney, and we had vaguely known him. And so I was sitting on the beach, and I didn't know him well, and he came up, and he said, you're Beverly. And I said, yes. And I thought, I just had this horrible, you know, how you say, you know, they tell you in the program to listen to your feelings, you know, your insides. And my stomach just turned over because he said, well, your husband tells me he's an alcoholic. And to find out the other side of the story, well, people were sunbathing, you know, and they kind of ooched over, you know, into the sand, you know. So I started telling, you know, I said, well, yes, and I did this, and I did that, and he did this. And I was going really fast. And I got to the point, and I said, and then I joined Al-Anon, and he sat straight up, and he just like we'd hit him with a cattle prod or something. He went, you joined Al-Anon? You can't possibly have joined Al-Anon. And I said, well, I did join Al-Anon. He said, you can't join Al-Anon. And I said, certainly I joined Al-Anon. He said, well, what is Al-Anon? And I said, he said, I must have a real confused idea. And I said, well, Al-Anon is the organization for the family and friends of alcoholics. And he went, my God. He said, I have been an assistant district attorney in Dallas. I have sent people to jail for alcoholism. We have sent them to AA for alcoholism. And he said, until this moment, I thought Al-Anon was the pill they gave AAs to keep them sober. Well, I was a pill, but I didn't keep him sober. You know, it was just so. But I'll tell you what that did for me. God used that to relieve me of the burden that I hadn't known about Al-Anon. Here was an assistant district attorney and thought Al-Anon was a pill. You know, so it relieved me of that feeling that where was I? You know, and I'll tell you where I was because I was not with it. You know, they say in the program, tell, you know, what we were like and what happened to us and what we're like now. And so I'll try to go through pretty briefly, and I would really, I really want to tell you I appreciate people at TAPE, and I know what it takes, and I know the hours that it does because that my husband does that in Texas. And so if I start running short on time, if you would please tell me, I would appreciate it because he will kill me if I go to two TAPEs. You know? I said that one time to somebody who was taping. I think it was in Nebraska, and they said, don't worry, Beverly, no Al-Anon knows enough to go to two tapes. But anyway, we've had the most wonderful, exciting life since we joined the program, and recovery is so wonderful and so beautiful, and my personal recovery means so much to me, and Al-Anon means everything in my life to me. It has given me everything. It has given me my spiritual life. It has given me my children back. It has given me a marriage that and a love with my husband that I did not dream was possible on this earth. It has made me everything I have today is because of Al-Anon. So I'm going to try to get through the but you know, you get so carried away with way I look back on the way I was, and it's like watching somebody else in a movie. And the things I'm going to tell you, I want to tell you, were not funny in any way when they were going on. They were the most serious, the most horrible, the most, I would lie in bed at night and think I was being suffocated with pillows. I mean, it was just awful. It was just awful. But today, it is absolutely hilarious to me. And I can laugh at it, and I hope that, you know, that you will get some enjoyment out of it. But I want you to understand, it was not funny when it was going on in any way. It was deadly serious. Today, it is very, very funny. I think alcoholism is the most frightening, the most deadly, cruel, mean, vicious disease in the world. But I came to understand that alcoholism was a disease, and that it was not my husband doing those things. It was the disease that was destroying both of us. And I know that alcoholism can kill the people around it, because that is what happened in our family. It was not the alcoholic who died, and I will cover that. But anyway, I was born into a family in Fort Worth, Texas, and I have always lived within two or three blocks of where I was born. My whole family lives there. No one has ever moved away. My mother and father, my father is 89 and my mother is 85, and they live about two blocks from us, and my brother lives down about two and a half blocks, and Buddy's sister lives about a block. One of our sons lives close to us, and I adore Fort Worth, Texas. I think it is the most wonderful, after Al-Anon, it's one of my favorite things in the whole world to talk about, because I love it, and I love the roots that we have there, and I love our life today. It is wonderful. But that has all been the gift of you all. But anyway, I was born, I was a depression baby, and my father was head of an oil company in Fort Worth, and in the 30s, oil business was really great, you know, and the country was very, very poor. And I can remember growing up in this household, which was a wonderful household. I had a wonderful mother, have a wonderful mother, wonderful father. It was not an alcoholic household. It was not a spiritual household either, but I was taken to Sunday school and that sort of thing. My father was the God in that household, and I just adored him. I just thought he was wonderful. And his name was Jaeger, and Charles Jaeger, and that's German, and it was a very Germanic type household. It was run very well organized. No extra money was spent for things or anything like that. But you had everything you wanted and everything you needed, and I got the blessing in that household. And I always, I heard this in Al-Anon, but it has meant a lot to me, that in your first household, if your parents loved you and made you feel like you were important and just loved you because you were their child, you got a blessing, that all your life was a wonderful thing for you to have. But if you came to this program and you didn't get the blessing in that first household, this program will give you the blessing far beyond what you could have ever gotten in your first household, because you get it with unconditional love. And you get it with a spiritual life that is so beautiful that it surpasses everything. But in that first household, I did get the blessing. And basically, my talk always deals with sex, God, and money, and not in that necessary order of importance. But that's just the way I cover it. In that household, there was not, as I said, it was not a spiritual household, but it was a very fine household and a very moral household. But when I was about 12 years old, I realized that there was this big subject out there called sex, and I didn't know anything about it, and I was sort of a lonely little girl. I had a German nurse and a German shepherd dog, and the dog didn't know anything about sex, I didn't think, and the nurse wasn't telling, you know, I decided that I would go down. I read early. I mean, I can't ever remember a time in my life I couldn't read. My mother taught me to read when I was just a tiny baby, and I've always adored read. Talking and reading were my big deals, and I talked all the time or I was reading. And so she had got me a library card really early. So when I was 12, I went down to the public library, and I took a basket, and I said, "Now, I want all your books on sex." And this librarian, you know, looked down and said, "We don't give little girls books on sex, you know." And I thought, well, you know, we're never daunted. You know, calling all the people in Charleston, West Virginia was nothing to me. So I simply looked around and I thought, now how am I going to learn everything about sex? And I thought, well, I'm going off to this camp in Wisconsin. And it was a 8-week camp. I thought, up at that camp, there are going to be these older women, 13, 14, 15, you know. And they can teach me everything about sex. So I went down to the corner drugstore, and I got a spiral notebook, and I tied a pencil on it, and put my name, address, and telephone number on the front page. And I started out on the train for Naugahuica in Wisconsin. And the first night, all the girls made jokes. And, of course, I didn't know what the jokes meant. But I copied every word down, and they were horrible, gross jokes. I don't know whether you know the kind of, you know, like the farmer's daughter and the traveling salesman and, you know, all this stuff. And I copied everything down. And when I finished, I didn't know what the words meant. So I had a vocabulary list that followed each joke. And I can remember that the first word in the vocabulary list was the F word, you know. And I said, "What's that?" And they told me. I was kind of surprised, you know. I said, "Well, you know," and I wrote it down as well as I could. And then the next word was like S-C-R-E-W, you know. I went, same as above, you know, and went on down my vocabulary list. Well, I was going to study that book when I got back to Fort Worth, so I'd know everything there was to need to know about sex. And I had this book. Oh, it was filled. I mean, it all 200 pages by the time the 8 weeks were over, just jammed, you know, with vocabulary lists and horrible jokes. And so I got that, none of which I laughed at, you understand, because I didn't, you know, they thought I was very peculiar, you know, because they'd tell a joke and I'd sidle up and start writing everything down. Well, I got home and I was so excited. I jumped off the Santa Fe Chief, and I remember just suddenly my stomach just fell because I looked back and I remembered I had left my book on the Santa Fe Chief with my name, address, and telephone number. And that's the way it was till I got to you all. I kept getting it all together and losing it. But anyway, that winter, when I was 13 years old, I went to a little party, and I looked across, and I saw the man that I was to love all the rest of my life to this day, and I just fell madly in love with him. I was straight up and down as a little string. I had never had a date in my life, and he was a freshman in college, and he was in a military school, and he had on this wonderful uniform, but he had the most wonderful other thing that you would want for your whole life and the father of your four children. I think he had a yellow Chrysler convertible with plaid upholstery. And he was mine. It was all over. He didn't ever see me. You know, I was over. But, I mean, I just looked around and said, that's it. You know, and I was talking to Vivian in the kitchen the other day, and she said she had done that with her husband. Now, and you have to be real careful, you know. And she was saying she didn't let him know it. And I didn't either, because, you know, you can lose them, you know, if you move too fast. And innately I knew all those things, you know, to do like that. And I became his greatest cheerleader. I mean, he would tell a joke across the room, and I would fall on the floor in hysterics. He would walk in a room, and I'd say, here he comes, isn't he adorable, isn't he precious? Well, that gets back to him. And if you're a good future alcoholic, it's a wonderful thing to have your own cheerleading squad, you know, walking along behind you, you know, walking in his shadow and holding his train is sort of the way I was. He was the source of all to me. He was the sun and the moon and the stars and everything in the world that was going to be wonderful. And I had my sex knowledge, you know, and hadn't had time to study it, but I was a little panicked about that. But I thought, well, he's going to come home from military school in the spring, and by then I will be old enough to have a date. And so I did, and I met him, and he at a dance, and he danced with me, and, oh, I was just beside myself. And then the next day I had to leave for this camp again. My mother kept sending me off to this camp all the time, you know. She didn't know what was going on at the camp, I'll tell you. But anyway, so I got on. He took me down to the train. We had two dates, and he took me down to the train, sent me off. Now, I was straight up and down as a little string, weighed 104 pounds, no bra, and this is before the days of no bra. It was just no need for a bra. But I mean, I worshiped him. Just, oh, he was wonderful. So he put me on the train, and I went off for 8 weeks. And that summer, the most wonderful thing happened to me. And that is that I was blessed by the chess fairy. I would lay upon my bunk and watch them grow, you know, just, and I would think, finally I started thinking, I wonder if they're going to stop, you know. I went from no bra to like a 36C or D, and they had to take me twice into Chicago to truss me up in things, you know, and I couldn't stand up. I mean, it was dramatic, you know, and none of my clothes fit. I had my first pair of high heels, and so I'd practice walking, you know, and it was awful. Then I also, that summer, joined the Episcopal Church. It was an Episcopal camp, and I went down to the bookstore right before I left for home, and I bought this enormous cross, and I like to say it went nipple to nipple. You know, it was just like this. And I would then practice, you know, how I was going to do. And I wanted him to notice me. Well, I swung off the train. I will never forget it. He was down there with my mother. And I got off the train with my cross and my high heels and my new front. And I turned sideways like this. And I remember he took one look at me and he went, oh, my God. and I knew I had him. And I did. I did. My mother cried. She knew we were in big trouble. But anyway, he went off to, you know, was in the service and was a pilot and was gone. And I went on through high school and went on to the University of Texas right at the end of the war. And I remembered when I checked into the university, I went straight into the Texas bookstore and I said, "Where are your books on sex?" And this woman said, "Right back there." You know, she didn't say we don't give little girls books on sex. So I went back and I grabbed this book and I threw it in with the English and history and the geology and everything. And when I got home, I realized, if you know, back then they didn't have, you know, these books, a whole section on sex like they have today. I had gotten a medical for 4 years and I knew everything. I mean, it was like those limp Bibles, you know, that they stand up on television. But that book was just, and I had to read it, you know, by flashlight and keep it under my mattress because I didn't want anybody to think I was obsessed, you know. And so anyway, we got married, and I remember the morning after we married, I said, "Well, listen, in this book," and I got my book out, and it was not the fourth step guide. I said, "In this book, it says on page 3 that you are supposed to do this," and he said, "Page 3 of what?" And I said, he was lying with his head on the pillow, "Page 3 of what?" I said, "Of my sex book." And so he took the book and had just hysterics on the bed because he had opened it up and it was published in 1917. Now, well, he took that book down to the Rotary Club and the, you know, the Chamber of Commerce. I would meet total strangers on the street and they would say, "Oh, you're the one with the sex book." Well, we had, you know, we were, I was very much in love with Buddy, and we had, I think, a wonderful life. And I remember we had four children. About the way those first years were. Anyway, we did, the sex book worked. We had four beautiful, wonderful children, and when we were first married, I remember that we used to drink Dr. Pepper on the rocks before before dinner. And then one day, you know, I think Al-Anons have blackouts. It was kind of like the next time I remember, we were drinking beer before dinner, and I remember thinking, really, just suddenly, I've got to open the second beer, because if I drink 2 beers, that means he will only drink 4 beers. Now, what happened is, when I'd open the second beer, he would go get another 6-pack, and that meant he drank 10 beers, or, you know, and you never win, but it was like there, I know there were times in there between the Dr. Peppers on the rocks and the 10 or 6 beers, but anyway, we were drowning in something, and I didn't know what it was, and there were lots of problems, and I would think, you know, I never thought it was alcohol. I thought he drank because of the problems, not because that the problems were coming because of the alcohol. I was as he went more and more into his disease, I went out into the world to escape. And what I did was I took over the Episcopal women in the Fort Worth Dallas diocese and became head of that, and I was running around telling them how to set up things, you know, groups and prayer groups, and I didn't even have a spiritual life. I remember standing in the back of the Episcopal church and the priest would be saying things. I think, I wonder if he believes all that, you know. That was the depth of my spiritual life, and it's very hard to say that today because it's embarrassing, but that was the way it was. And Vivian and I were talking about politics, and I said, well, I can remember being, you know, like co-chairman for the state for the women for Eisenhower and things like that. Just any job, I mean, whatever it was, you know, we can do it. And it was just like, I said at our state convention, we're going to have a bionic Al-Anon, you know, and it's going to be all fixed because we can do anything, you know, just, oh, yes, you need something? Oh, I'll do that. You know, sure, I'm great at that. But it was not ever, things were not going well at home, and so it's much easier to run away in your head that way other places. I got a master's in the Tang Dynasty of 7th and 8th century Chinese poetry, and I have I have yet to have anybody wander up to me and say, tell me all about the Tang, you know. I used to sidle up to almost perfect strangers and say, did you have orange juice for breakfast? And they'd say, yes or no. And I'd say, have you ever tried Tang? And then they'd say, and then I'd say, that's really interesting, you know, that you bring that up. Because I was desperate to tell people about the Tang dynasty, you know. But that was the kind of escape things that I did. I finally became a teacher and taught British literature and loved, oh, I adore adolescents. They're my favorite people next to alcoholics. I just love them. And I love to teach. I used to just, you know, they said she acts like she'd pay to teach, and I really almost would have because it was a lot saner world than what was going on at home. I'm going to take you through a day and a night of our life, and then you can just project that for about 10 years of the really kamikaze bad drinking. I would wake up in the morning. Now, I want to tell you, I had gone from this cheerleader, this where, you know, my husband was the god in my life, through the years of he just became a couch potato. You know, he just laid on the couch and just drank, and he was a real estate broker, but he didn't ever attend work. You know, he would have laid there all the time, and I would kind of lift him up by the back of the, you know, thing and talk to him like that, like they're going to cut the water off, and he'd say, that's nice, you know, and I'd put him back down. And so I was, you know, everything. And, you know, his deal, he says today is, you know, he knew he could just stay there till he died or whatever would happen to him as long as he just didn't rattle my cage. And he'd kind of pat me and say, you're wonderful. And I'd say, I know it, you know, and I'd go back out to do whatever I was doing. I wouldn't say it, but I mean, you know, I'd think, I am wonderful. I'm supporting this family. I'm doing all this. And he doesn't feel well. And, you know, and he's had all these bad things happen to him. But anyway, our day and night would go like this. I would wake up in the morning, and I would wake him up, and he would run in the bathroom, and he would throw up. And then I would go in the bathroom, and I would clean him up. And I would tell him if he didn't smoke so much, he wouldn't throw up in the morning. And then I would sit him on the side of the bed, and I would take his pajama shirt off and his pajama pants off, and then I'd put his shirt on, and then I'd put his pants on, and then I would zip him up, and he would scream, and I didn't care. You know. He always said it was a miracle there was any sex left when he finally got to the program. And he always introduces himself as the abused spouse of an Al-Anon, and that he is married to the only Al-Anon in the world who used a zipper as a weapon. But anyway, I would zip him up, and he would scream. And then I would wake the four children, and I would get them all out on the driveway, and I would get him in the car. Now, we had a big 9-passenger station wagon that was just dying of alcoholic rash. It had been beaten and hit, and, you know, and it was rusting up the sides, you know, and it did like this. And I'd get him behind the wheel, and he'd be kind of looking like this, kind of bleary-eyed, because he was an hourly drinker and had been drinking all night. And then I would get the children out. We'd all get on the driveway, and we'd say, goodbye, Daddy. Have a great day, Daddy. And they'd all blow kisses, you know, and I'd say, have a wonderful day at work, darling. Now, darling didn't have a job, you know. But he had to be gone from 9 to 5 because, you see, the neighbors might find out that there was something wrong in our household. So I had given him a library card, and he was supposed to go to the library. He had his basket, and he had his card, you know. And you can't get in trouble at the public library. So he knew where he was supposed to go, and the children were all dancing up and down, and I was, and we were blowing kisses, and he would wobble the car, you know, out of the driveway. And then I would say, okay, kids, and we'd all jump in this little bitty, little tiny Volkswagen Bug that had one of those little bitty windows in the back, and the four children and I would jump in there, and then I'd circle the park and pick up a couple of more children because I was a very good mother, and I was going to schools anyway, and so they'd stick, and we looked like those little clowns, you know, with their heads all sticking out. And one time when I was speaking, somebody came up afterwards and said, why didn't you take the 9-passenger station wagon and give him the bug? That never occurred to me, you know. So I would start out, and as I would go by the elementary school, I would start slowing down. The older children would start saying, jump, 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 because I didn't stop. I'd just kind of slide by, you know, and they'd leap out. And then I'd go by the junior high school, same deal, jump, jump, and they'd jump, and I'd wave, you know, laughing, you know, and drive on up to the high school, and the rest of us would jump out at the high school, and I'd run in front of up into my English class, and oh, as I said, I adored to teach, and I would walk back and forth, and I love British literature, and I love British poetry, and I was teaching seniors, and I was head of the department, so I taught honors students, and I would walk back and forth, and I remember one day I was walking along, and I was going, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing. And I was crying, just sobbing. And this boy, a big old football player on the front row went, just doesn't grab me like it grabs her. The bell would ring, and I would race home, because I had second period off. I had arranged that because I had to get home and check on him and make sure that he had gone where he was supposed to go. And I had a very busy daily schedule, and I had to get all that taken care of, because if I routed him out one time in Tara, he wouldn't go back the rest of the day, because he never knew when I'd come home. The school was real close to our home. So I would run, jump in the car. Other teachers were grading papers and, you know, doing the things teachers do, not me. I was in the car headed home, and I would roar that car up into the parking lot. I mean, in the parking lot, that's almost what it was, because we had so many, But anyway, up into the driveway, and I would kick the door open, and I would run into the bedroom, and he would be back in bed in his pajamas with a vodka bottle on the pillow, and I would scream, what in the hell do you think you're doing? And he would jump up like this, and he'd run in the bathroom and throw up, you know. I mean, you know, just... That was his normal reaction to me. And so I would run in the bathroom, and I would rip his pajama shirt. He didn't have buttons for years, because I just would rip it off, you know. And I'd clean him up, and then he would come in and sit down. I'd put his shirt on, I'd put his pants on, I'd zip him up, he'd scream, I'd laugh, you know. And then I would get out in the driveway, and I'd say, you get to the public library. And so he would say, all right, you know, wobble the car out. This time, I would follow him, because I had 50 minutes. And I would follow right behind him. And if he tried to turn off, I'd head him off, you know. And after a year or two, I got really bored with doing that, and I'd think, I need to trust him more. I hear people talking about, you need to, if you don't trust your husband, how do they know? You know, normal people out there. So I would let him think he had escaped. I'd give him this little test, and I'd drive about two blocks, about a block up from him, and I'd check him, you know, as he'd pass the intersections near our house, and after about the second street, he'd start smiling. You know, he'd be looking like this, and he'd think he'd gotten away from me, or I'd had to go back to school. So he would turn to go into this Andy Capp's bar, which was about four blocks from our house, and when he turned, I would just put the pedal to the metal, and I would roar that Volkswagen down, and I would ram his car, and his head would do like this on the car. And I would lean out of the car, and I would say, you get to the public library. And he'd say, all right, you know. And he'd turn the car and, you know, head for the library. Now, you know, a Volkswagen does not have a motor in the front. And he was in a big, like a Chrysler or DeSoto or some kind of that big old station wagon. And I was taken to the hospital paralyzed one day with, you know, no back digits and or whatever those things, discs. And they kept saying, what have you done to yourself? And I said, nothing. You know, it never occurred to me when his head was down, his mind was just like this. Well, all of that happened within about four blocks of where we live. And so when we got to the program and he was running around the park telling everybody he was in AA, not a single person in the Monticello Rivercrest area thought he was the alcoholic. They all thought it was me, you know. They really did. And, you know, they kept saying, it couldn't have been that sweet Buddy Ross. You don't mean he was the alcoholic, you know. And so that's kind of, you know, the way that went. Now, I would go back to school, and I did the cheerleaders, and I was a Bluebird mother and a Cub Scout mother and all of those things. And, I mean, I was busy. But I had read this book by Mary Bella Morgan that was called The Total Woman, and it said that... I see a few of you have read it. One of the things was to wrap yourself in saran and meet your husband at the door, you know, that would get him interested. I never did figure out how I could do that with four children, but I did read in her book that the man that drinks at home, doesn't drink in bars. So I thought, aha. So I bought a little bar and a cocktail shaker and a little book that said Mr. Boston's Guide to, I thought it said Alcoholism Today, but anyway, I think it said Mixed Drinks. And being an organized person, I started on page one with the first of the month. That was the drink we had, and page two was the second drink. And I taught myself to make these. Well, anyway, we had this cocktail hour. I decided we'd have a cocktail hour at 5 o'clock, and I had to fix little hors d'oeuvres and everything. And right about 5 minutes of 5, I'd set the timer, and I'd tell all the children they had to go back in the back, and I'd lock the door, keep them in the back, and then I'd put the little things out, and I'd put the music on, and I'd light the candles. And right at 5 o'clock, he would ring the doorbell. Now, I did not give him a house key. And I would go to the door, and I would say, who is it? And he would say, it's me. And I would say, have you had anything to drink? And he would go, no. And believing him, as I always did, I would open the door, and maybe I'd say, oh, we're going to have Brandy Alexander's or whatever that day was. And I love things with a lot of sugar and a lot of fruit and everything and a lot of cream. And sometimes I'd put ice cream in it, you know, and I'd be mixing up these things. And he would be looking at it with this horrible look, you know. And I would mix it up and I would give him a drink. And I'd say, isn't this fun? And I'd be entertaining him, telling him all the fun, funny, cute things I could think of. And suddenly, right in the middle, just when he finished the drink, he'd just pass out. And I would lift him back up and say, you can have another drink. And he would say... well, all right. Then I would run back and I would start fixing dinner and I would, you know, get all the stuff out. And the children usually by then were beating on the door, you know, to get out. I'd run unlock them and they'd run to the table. Now, we ate very fast meals. And they were very much family style. And I mean, I would just slap everything on the table. And, you know, people would be snatching and grabbing things because the minute that he was through with the meal, and he didn't eat a lot at that time, dinner was over. And so they would knew they had to eat fast, and sometimes he'd just eat a biscuit or two and say, well, I guess I'll go to bed. You know, I'd say, well, that's it. You know, and I'd just start taking everything off the thing. And the children would be reaching, you know, they hadn't even had the meat yet. And I'd say, everybody back in the bedrooms, everybody back in, you know, go on to your bedroom, time to study. And then I'd throw the dishes in the dishwasher and slam everything into the refrigerator because I had to get to bed fast for sex. I had studied forever. So I would be running across the den, you know, unbuttoning my dress, getting ready to throw my negligee on, and I would roar into the bedroom, and of course he would just be comatose, you know, out. And I would lift him up like this, and I'd say, do you want sex? And he'd go, no, no, no. I would then literally pass out. I was so exhausted. I don't know about you all, but I was tired. And when I got to Al-Anon and met women that had affairs, I admired those women. God. They must have been taking vitamins that I never heard of. I don't know how you work that in that schedule. You know, it was amazing. Well, anyway, I would just pass out, just unconscious almost. And after I'd been asleep a little bit, then he would wake up, you see, and look over. And of course, I was out. And then he would be up for the night to drink. And so after about 2 or 3 hours, I would feel in the bed, and he'd be gone. So then I slept in little pink knitted booties, because if you sleep in little booties, you don't have to turn on a light to find your house shoes. And then we'd start on this deal of search and destroy. And I would get out of the bed, slip out in the dusk, and I would go through the children's rooms, and I'd go in the bathroom, and I'd look in the closets because I knew he was someplace where he had hidden a bottle. And so I would go through the house like this, and I would find him, and say it would be in the kitchen, and I would stand there, not let him see me. And I would stand in the shadows until he finished that drink, and he would mix another drink, and I would wait till that drink got right to his lips, but not one drop touched it. And then I would throw the lights on, and I'd scream, "What in the hell do you think you're doing?" You know? And he would throw the drink all over everything. It's like, "My God, Beverly, I'm a hopeless alcoholic. I'm trying to have a drink." And I would scream, "You are not an alcoholic. I never want to hear that word in this household." And I would race across the kitchen, and he weighed at this time about 280 pounds. He was no match for me. I would grab him by the back of the pajamas. I would race him across that kitchen floor. His little feet would be trying to get traction, you know. I'd get him as far as the den, and then I'd turn around and say, "Do you want sex?" And he'd go, "No, no." Well, that was the way it was, one day at a time, till we got to you all, you know. Anyway, we led the most frantic, ridiculous life, and it turned me from, you know, just being an adoring cheerleader into just a total controlling, you know, I was like Hitler, you know, it's the only way I can describe it, you know, and it was just, I can remember being outside and talking the facade of my life out, talking to him in the living room, and I would leave the front door open and I'd be out there planting flowers. Now, he was not in the living room. He would be passed down in bed, but the neighbors had to think everything was all right. So I would say, "Darling, do you think I ought to put the marigolds here?" And I'd say, "Oh, well, all right, I'll put them over here." And I remember our four-year-old coming to the door one day and looking, you know, like that, you know, and he never asked me who I was talking to, or, you know. So, you know, they really did, as we hear in the program, they understood what was wrong with Buddy. They did not understand what was wrong with me. And I didn't understand what would have happened to my life, but I knew that things were just awful. Anyway, in a moment of great clarity, which happens in so many alcoholics' lives if they do get to the program, he was in a bar, and he said it was like, this voice came in his mind, "If you do not stop drinking, you are going to lose your wife and your children and your life." And so he called his doctor and said, "Gordon, I am a hopeless alcoholic, and I would like to get sober." And Gordon said, "Fine, come over to the hospital, and I'll put you in for 2 or 3 days, and we were together. So he said to Gordon, "The only problem I have, Gordon, is Beverly." And Gordon said, "Well, doesn't Beverly want you to be sober?" And said, "Well, no, it's not that. It's that Beverly does not think I'm an alcoholic. And she will never allow me to go into a hospital on an alcoholic ward. She will come get me." And and I would have. And so the Gordon said, "Well, you leave it to me. I'll check in the hospital, and I'll call Beverly and tell her." So he called me at school. And I thought Buddy'd been in a wreck. They called me up here and said they'd put him in the hospital. I said, "My Lord, what happened?" "Well, he says he's a hopeless alcoholic," and I'm going to, you know, and oh, my heavens, I remember I thought, "Oh, here he has told me that every day for 10 years, and I've never believed that." And he told the doctor one time, "He's just going over there to get clean sheets, meals on time, and to get away from me," see. So, oh, I was furious. So if you ever are dealing with somebody where the denial is horrible and the spouse acts terrible, you can remember me. If there's hope for me and it happened to me, it can happen to them. I raced over to that hospital. I had no coping system. I had no spiritual life. I had never once in 20 years of alcoholism told one person what was going on in our household. The priest in our church one time, because Buddy had talked to him, said, "Things are going to get better." And I remember I just drew back from him like a firebrand, and I said, "I have no idea what you're talking about," and turned around and walked away from him. My parents were scared. They would come. My mother would come to the door, and I would come to the door and say, "What is it you need?" You know, I wouldn't let her in the household. So when I'm saying, you know, I didn't confide in anybody. My pride and my denial was total. And I was very sick, you know, I know today. But anyway, I had no coping system, so I raced to the hospital. I ran up the flights of stairs to the 7th floor, and I kicked the door open, and I said, "What in the hell do you think you're doing?" And he jerked the sheet up like this and said, "Beverly, I'm a hopeless alcoholic. I'm trying to get sober." And I said, you are not an alcoholic. I don't want to hear you use that word. And I said, somebody's going to come down this hall. They put you up here on the chest surgery floor. You don't even have an incision. You know, I was furious. And there was a man between Buddy and me going, you know, hooked up to these life-giving things. And I was so sensitive, you know, to the needs of others that I looked down at this man and I said, well, they're going to come down and they're going to know you're not a chest surgery patient. I said, look at him. He's going, and you're not doing that, you know. Well, he stayed and he has never had a drink from the moment he entered that hospital. And he went to Alcoholics Anonymous and he went crazy. That's the only way I can describe it. He went totally nuts. I mean, he was bananas. He was going around the park, just like with a tambourine. I'm in AA. I'm in AA. I was just like, it was all I could do to keep him from putting it on the answering service. You know, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have something you need. You know, well, I was less than thrilled. I mean, I cannot tell you how I responded to that. But I thought, as I said, they would find him out and kick him out. And, you know, it was just going to be a matter of time. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic in my life. Actually, I didn't have to get him dressed, and he didn't throw up, and we didn't have to zip him up and all that, and he didn't scream. And, you know, so things were better there. And the children, I wasn't locking them out so much, you know, I mean, into their rooms. And so, you know, things were improving. But I can remember that about 60 days into the program, his liver collapsed. And this time the doctor raced him to the hospital, called me and said, Buddy has cirrhosis of the liver. His liver is not functioning, and he may not make it. He is very, very seriously ill. Well, I had not been to Al-Anon. I had no coping system. I had no spiritual life. And when, you know, we just do the same things over and over till we can get here. And so I jumped in that car and I was in a rage. And I remember I raced to that hospital. I was mad at God. I was mad at life. I mean, how dare this happen? He had never had even a parking ticket. I'd had thousands of parking tickets. He had never written a hot check. I had written so many hot checks that I had to go out from the grocery store out and wake him up in the car and have him sign the check because my checks wouldn't go through, you know, Checktronic. You know, but I was furious that he was dying. Just absolutely furious. How dare he die and leave me with all these children, and what did he think he was doing, you know, and all of this stuff. And anyway, I got to that hospital and I ran up to the second floor and I kicked that door open and I said, you will not die of cirrhosis of the liver. I will think of something else. And he said, whatever you want me to die of, I'll die. Well, he came home from that hospital, and he really started working the program. And he really, of course, he loved Alcoholics Anonymous and was just adored it. And he went to 3 and 4 meetings a day, which was great because he didn't work. So, you know, but anyway, it was wonderful. It was marvelous. But it wasn't me. You know, you can't get the program just because somebody you're married to is in recovery. And also, if somebody you're married to is in recovery, and you're sitting out there tonight, and somebody at home isn't in the program, I want to tell you, you're having a tremendous impact on that whole family. Because I watched him start a spiritual life. I watched him start doing the steps. And I was just back there. I was just out there. And I have never felt so alone and so lost. And so my way was control. And so one day I said to him, today you are going to go to church with me. It was Sunday. And I said, it's very embarrassing that you are not going to the Episcopal Church with me. And people are asking where you are. And he said, tell them. And I said, I wasn't about to do that. And he said, well, I have found the God of my understanding at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am not going to church with you today. So I said, well, very well. I am going to go with you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am going to take a notebook, and I am going to take everybody's name down. And I said, furthermore, I am going to look them all in the face, because I thought we weren't supposed to look people in the face. And those people that had come to call on Buddy in the hospital that had the little books under their arms, I would just do this and walk out of the room, because I thought that was anonymity. So I got my book and I got my pencil, and I said, let's go. And he let me go. And we went. You know, I don't know that I'd let him come to an Al-Anon meeting like that, but that's the way I went. It was an open AA meeting. And I walked through the doors of that meeting, and I can remember finding just what I found here and in meetings all over every place we've ever been. And that is this love and this joy and this hope and this feeling that I really, you know, I didn't even know heaven had things like that. and people were hugging and laughing, and oh, Lord, I dropped that book. I hugged and I laughed and I kissed, and my word, here was a whole room full of alcoholics, all groups that I could help, and I, you know, oh, loved them. And I remember these women that were just beautiful, and they were AA women, and they were so fixed up, and they were so cute, and I said, oh, I want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I have a very sincere desire to stop drinking. And I had read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, just the only requirement for membership is a sincere desire to stop drinking. And they said, well, when were you last drunk? And I had never been drunk. I never had time to get drunk, you know. And but I told them I would if that would help me get in. Oh, I wanted to be an AA so badly. And they would not, the integrity of their program is they would not take me. And they finally, after a couple of open meetings, they said, you need to go with them. And I said, well, who are them? And they said, the Al-Anons. Now, it is embarrassing, since Al-Anon is the most precious thing in my life today, to stand here and tell you that I looked over at them, and this is the way they looked at me. And they were looking at me, you see, because he had been telling them for a year, you know, we've got to get her to Al-Anon, we've got to get her, you know, some way, you know. And they had heard a lot of them. They'd watched me, you know, cry, beg to go to AA, you know, I'll get drunk if you'll take me, you know. They thought I was very peculiar, you know. So anyway, I said, well, I'm not going with them. Those are the alcoholics. I'm not going with them. So I'll just go to open AA meetings, and I'll just sit outside in the little coffee room while you have a closed meeting. And so he had started taping conferences, and he said, why don't you go to Longview with me? And I said, now, buddy, I will go to a conference with you, but I want to tell you, I am not an Al-Anon. I never intend to be an Al-Anon, and I don't want Al-Anon on my badge in Longview. He said, well, honey, there is not a soul in Fort Worth, Texas that thinks you are an Al-Anon. I thought that was a compliment, you know. So we went down there, and that particular year they had red badges for the AAs and blue badges for the Al-Anons, and they gave me a white badge that said visitor. And this is why I love conferences and why I am so dedicated to going to conferences. I think it is the icing on the cake of our program, because you get out of your little world and you get to hear people from other places. And I was sitting in the second row where the lady in blue is at the meeting where the Al-Anon talked. Of course, I went to all the meetings, and so I heard Gracie A. from Dallas, and she was talking, and I started crying for the first time in 11 years, and I just, tears just streamed down my cheeks, and my Lord, when she finished, if she had said, come up and be dunked, I would have done that, you know. Come up and slit your wrist and bleed with us, I would have done that. And I joined Al-Anon. I want to tell you, I joined. Oh, my Lord. No wonder we looked like this. We had lived with them, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And I went home, and Al-Anon was to be my life forever, and it is almost the way it is. But I went home, and I whipped through that room with all those alcoholic women and alcoholics. I said, hello. And they said, my God, what happened to you? They said, well, she joined Al-Anon. And so I went into the Al-Anon room, and at the back of the room, I saw what was to be for me the most wonderful thing in the world, because here was this bookcase full of Al-Anon books, and I never had sat down in the meeting. I went over and put my arm up on it, and I said, I would like to be your literature chairman. And they said, well, all right. You know, no one had asked to be. And I took every book home, and I read it, and I underlined it, and I made notes about it. And if you could just get it out of a book, I would have gotten it. We have the most wonderful literature in the world, but it takes other things. It takes meetings, and it takes the personal life, and it takes the meditation, and it takes the steps, and it takes the steps, and it takes the steps, and it takes the sponsor, and all of those other things. But I love the literature, and I started my little walk, and it was funny that Kitty had the, you know, guide to the four-step thing, because I didn't want to do the fourth and fifth step. He had done the fourth and fifth step, and I knew what that took out of, you know, and the kind of honesty it was going to take, and I didn't want to tell anybody how crazy I had been. But my sponsor put her hands on my face and said, you know, you've got to do the steps. You've got to do the fourth and fifth step. And so I said, well, Eloise, I will do the fourth and fifth step if you will promise me that you will not change my personality. Because I said, You haven't lived in Fort Worth long. But if you had, you would know I have a wonderful personality. And you would not want me to change it. And I used to say, she lied and they did. Now, that's really not true, because what happened was it didn't change my personality as much as it changed my character. And it gave me a moral system and a value system and a spiritual life and a way to live that is incredible. And it was the most wonderful, exciting thing. Now, 2 years into the program for me, I suddenly realized that something was really wrong in my marriage. And I didn't know what it was, because everything was wonderful. We were recovering, certainly spiritually and financially and emotionally and mentally and all of those ways. And the sex was wonderful and life was wonderful and we were doing all of these wonderful things. But I just knew inside something was wrong. So one day when I was meditating, I said, now, God, I want to be the kind of wife you want me to be. And if I'm doing something I shouldn't do, or, you know, please let me know. Well, you know, they say, don't ask or you will find out. And so about 3 days later, I was, we were talking about something, and I said, something is really wrong, and it's not this. It's something's wrong in the marriage. And he said, well, they told me not to tell you this, but I really don't love you anymore. I don't hate you. I just don't have any feeling for you at all. Well, I was just devastated. I mean, I've had the biggest Al-Anon slip you have ever seen. I just went into, how dare he not love me? I mean, all how as wonderful as I was to him all those years, you know, how dare he not love me? And I went racing down to the public library, and I took this basket, and I got all the books on divorce, how to divorce and get everything, how to divorce and kill them, how to divorce and be the best friend, you know. And I got home, and he had not gone to the office that day, and there were flowers, and he cried, and I cried, and he said, I don't want a divorce. And today I know that he had just lost his feelings, and he didn't know how to love, and he didn't know how to, you know, our deal had been so sick for all those years that marriage needed to die, and that is what we decided, and we were very fortunate. And that we let that marriage die, and we rebuilt a new marriage. And we built it on the traditions of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous, the tradition that says you need to be financially independent. And we had not been financially independent, because my father would come in and pay up the house for a year or give us cars or do these things. And we had to go to him, them, my parents, and say, we cannot do this anymore. We have got to be independent. And when we decided to do that, tremendous financial recovery came to my husband, and he retired me from teaching, and I mean it was wonderful. And every time we've done what the program tells us to do, it has been wonderful. One of the ones that meant the most to us was principles above personalities, because we have 4 children, they have lots of personalities, and we found we were enabling one. I was terribly, because he had suffered the most, you know, and all that kind of thing. And so we learned, and we studied people that we thought had good marriages, and we had a lot of help out of the program with that. But today we have the most wonderful, wonderful marriage, I really feel, but it is one day at a time, you know, and it is a precious gift each day. Several years ago, my buddy I shattered both my arms and was in the hospital for 12 or 15 days in traction, and just as they got cured up, he had bypass surgery, and they took him early, and our crowds of AAs and Al-Anons who are so wonderful and had been are also close to us had not gotten there. But I didn't have to kick the door open and say, you know, you are not going to have bypass surgery. I'll think of something else. I felt like, God had wrapped me in cotton. You know, I was so taken care of. And the program people, he'd been in the hospital a week, and the program people had just been there day and night having meetings. And several nurses came to Al-Anon. One, Kathy, that we just love, who has been in the program, goes every night, and came just because of the way that the spiritual life that she saw through the people that came to see us and the way we felt about that operation. Another great lesson I had in the program was that, which just was really painful. Well, the marriage thing was painful, but this was really painful. After I did my steps, I realized that I did not react normally to suicide. If there was a suicide, no matter if it was a next-door neighbor's child or anything, I could not handle it. I did not go. I did not write a note. I didn't send anything. I didn't take anything. And I knew, I had blocked out the fact that my husband's mother had committed suicide. How am I doing on time? How much more time? Okay. Now, don't let me get in trouble in Texas, okay? Anyway, that she had committed suicide. And she had been my very best friend. She was the great gift of the marriage to me, other than my husband. She was just like my husband. She was adorable and precious and cute. And marvelous personality, and I saw her every day. We shopped together, we did things, we talked on the phone. I just loved her to death. And one day, but I've never let her discuss anything was wrong. You know, I never confided in her one thing was wrong. And if she'd ever start to broach that maybe something was wrong with Buddy, I couldn't handle that. Her other child was also an alcoholic, her daughter, and she lived with her. And one day, this woman that I love more than anybody in the world, outside of my husband and children, took a knife and cut her throat. And we got there before the ambulance and the police and everything, and I can remember grabbing my husband's arm and saying, "It's not your fault. It is not your fault." Now, you know whose fault I thought it was. I thought it was mine, because I had been with her every day. He was sick or in his problems, and I should have known. I was a teacher. I'd had a lot of counseling. I'd had a lot of stuff, and I just couldn't handle it, and I just blocked it out, and I just... The way it reacted was, I just didn't have anything to do with suicides. Well, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that your dark past is your greatest asset. And that is one of the things that happened in the program with me. Because today, if there is a suicide, I am usually the first one there. And I can put my arms around them and say, it's not your fault. It is not your fault. And today I know that she is all right, and she knows that we're all right. And I feel her presence many times. And I can, there is no horror with it. It is just, that's the way it was, and I can accept that. And so that has been a wonderful gift to me. We have four wonderful children, and I'm not going to really dwell on them, but they have all come to Al-Anon, and that has been a great joy for me. None of them went into AA. I really thought we were going to have one do it, but and he may still someday, but he is not. One of them is an American, the oldest is an American airline pilot. And he has had a wonderful life and has lived all over the world. He's been to the South Pole for 2 years, and he won the International Balloon Races at the World Fair in New Orleans, and he's led a wonderful life. And our middle son is an underwater diver and does photography and has worked for Jean-Jacques Cousteau, and he's in the Virgin Islands. And our baby son, we always say, went to Alateen and overreacted and became a missionary to India. And... and our daughter, who has... three of our beautiful grandchildren, lives in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and she raises and trains horses, and she's always been a big rider, and she's married to a rancher, and they have wonderful, wonderful lives and very, very blessed by the program of Al-Anon. We've just had so many blessings that it is hard to tell them all to you, but one thing that I do, I feel like I'm leaving something out I want to tell, but I know that God is with us, and my most exciting thing that has ever happened to me in my life was last April the 2nd was my 10th Al-Anon birthday, and it was a big deal for me, and I was so excited about it and the things that we were going to do, and I was going to be at a woman-to-woman conference in Texas that I just love to celebrate because they have a great big birthday cake, and something just kept saying to me in January, you're not going to go to the woman-to-woman conference. You're going to give up your place for somebody else. There's always about 300 people on the waiting list. And I thought, well, that's weird. But I just kept saying, you're not going to go. You know, somebody else is supposed to go. So I thought, well, okay. So I didn't send in my registration. And I'm on the board down there. And they called me and said, you're not coming. I said, no, I'm not coming. And so about a week after that, we were contacted to go into the Soviet Union with an AA team, and there would be two other Al-Anons, and they would fly to the Soviet Union on April the 2nd, which was my 10th Al-Anon birthday. And so I want to spend a few minutes with that because it was so exciting, and it just absolutely impacted my life forever and ever. The secretary of the central office in Southern California was one of the Al-Anons that went, and then there was another Al-Anon that I took because Gorbachev approved originally 5 trips of 20 to come in. AA is who he wanted. And so we went in on citizen diplomatic passes, and they two groups had gone in ahead of us, and we went in April, and we sailed from Finland across the sea in 3 feet of ice and went into Leningrad, and the Russians were wonderful to us. The Soviet citizens were marvelous to us. And we ate in the homes every night because we ate with dissidents who hated the government. We ate with KGB officers. We ate with party members. We ate with just people. We ate with Russian Orthodox people. We ate with Methodists in their church. The first day we were there, we went to the Methodist church in Salem, which is a medieval city in Estonia. And the Methodist minister, who was Russian, had met us and asked us to come because he had heard of Perkins Institute at SMU in Dallas and had some correspondence with him and had heard we were coming. So he had us to the church, and we went, and the churches are packed in Russia, absolutely packed. And they had saved a row for us, and we went in, and he talked on the seeds, and they transfer, you know, the seeds that fall on fallow soil and the seeds that fall on good soil, you know, out of, it was a biblical thing. And it was beautiful, and we sang all the hymns like Rock of Ages and Amazing Grace, and all, oh, it was just, we cried, you know, and they cried. We went outside, and one of our people, they told us to bring in a lot of presents, and one of our people had brought in all these seeds that on the back of it said, "We bring you seeds of hope and love and sobriety." And so she gave these three packages of seeds to this Russian woman. Well, she ran back in, and she got all of the people in the church, and they lined up, and they held their hands out, and they put three little seeds in each hand, and they were chrysanthemum seeds, and they, the Russian people just cried, and we didn't understand what was going on. We thought, well, it must be the sermon. Well, what it was, in the Soviet Union, flowers are the only thing they can grow for money and keep the money, and so it was just like we were giving them money. And so it was so dramatic, and we just had thing after thing like that happen to us. It was just like God had done it. They sent us to different homes. Like, for example, I ate with an English teacher who was married to a party member whose first husband had died of alcoholism, to show, give her the literature. We had, by this time, literature translated into Russian, and they all speak English. They take English through high school. And it was really exciting. We went into Tartu in Estonia, and that lady is still in touch with me. She sent me some chocolate and some stuff, and has, and I remember talking to her, and her just crying, you know, because there was nothing for the women. They were all men alcoholics, and they had been in this place. They had a little sobriety group, and they had had some of them 20 years sobriety in this little group, but they had never moved out of this one little building in this one little town. It had never spread. But there was nothing for the families. And so she is having meetings of the families in Estonia, and she is in touch with me, and that is exciting. And we had wonderful, wonderful things happen. The first day we were in Leningrad, there was a man that was running toward us saying, "Sarah, Sarah," we wore these big yellow badges that said sobriety one day at a time, and he, all the groups had worn these badges, and he'd say, "Sarah, Sarah," and well, none of us were named Sarah, but Sarah, Sarah Sieberling, I think was her name, had led the first group in. And he had been sober since the first group came in, and he had kept two men sober. And, of course, he never thought he'd see anybody again. And he saw these yellow buttons, and he was just weeping. And, of course, we were weeping, and the AA said, "We'll meet you back here tonight at the subway." Well, they met, and he started telling them how he had had this big spiritual experience and how he'd joined the church and how he'd been sober, and these other two had been sober, and he and what it had meant to him. And the head of the little restaurant where we were made them leave and said, "You're talking to Americans, you're anti-Soviet, you're talking about religion," and made them leave. The next day he came to our hotel and told us that he had lost his job because of that. And, you know, we were just horrified. But he said, "It doesn't matter. I can get another job. I would be dead if it was not for the message that was brought by Alcoholics Anonymous a year ago." And he said, "I can get another job." Well, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says, "Job or no job, wife or no wife, your sobriety comes first." And I always read those chapters to people I sponsor, and particularly that, because I know how I felt when my husband came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not think his sobriety came first. And so, but it does. And in the Soviet Union, it really does come first, job or no job, because he lost his job. And we are so lucky here in the United States to have this country and have this system and have this program, that you can go to meetings in the Metroplex where I live. You can go to thousands of meetings. You can go to 10 meetings a day if you want to. And to have to think that you'd have to wait a year to ever see anybody come back with literature that would love you as we love each other. When we left, we cried. You know, it was like just watching these little birds that you just hand them the Salomon literature and say, "Hope you can get it started. Goodbye." And sail off. And, you know, probably we'll never go back. It was, a lot of them write us, and we cry a lot, but it changed us. It changed our life, and that was the gift that you all gave us, the gift that we came in here sick and ill and crazy, and you gave us the kinds of gifts that we could do something like that. And I don't want you to think we were like Bill and Bob or Lois or anything. It wasn't like that at all. Nobody represents Al-Anon and AA. These were groups that were set up that wanted to do this, that were asked to do it. We were more like the little Indian scouts that say, "You think it'll work over here? You know, well, then you need to write, you know, get yourself registered." After we were there in April, the first open AA meeting was registered in Leningrad. And they have now had Al-Anon meetings at Dr. Drysdorf's clinic in Moscow and also in Tartu in Estonia. So we're excited, and I feel if peace comes to the world, it will come through the 12 steps of, that Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon are spreading, because you just can't hate people who are in our program. You just can't. And it was a wonderful thing. And I would like to close with a quote that I love, and it's from St. Thomas Aquinas, and I found it at an Al-Anon retreat center like this in a library when I was reading some books one morning. And it really suited me, and it said, "When we reach the day of judgment, we will not be asked what we have read, but what we have done. And we will not be asked how well we've talked, but how well we've lived." And I'd like to thank each and every one of you for giving me the gift of life.